This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Welcome to Newfoundland and Labrador This Week. I'm John Soper. Coming up, Jack Troke of Quillingate is one of the better-known advocates of rural life in this province. But do you know his wife, Florence? John Furlong of the Fisheries Broadcast will be here with a gem of an interview that will change that. General Rick Hillier pays a visit to St. John's, and volunteers in Gander put together care packages for some of his troops stationed away from home. But to begin with, there was a gun scare on the main campus of Memorial University this week. It turned out to be a pellet gun scare, but Tuesday afternoon, police and campus security were looking for a man who'd been seen in the engineering building with what looked like a handgun. Eventually, the police handcuffed third-year engineering student Christopher Hardy. He readily admitted he had a pellet gun in his knapsack. Later, he talked with CBC television reporter Linda Calvert about why he had the weapon. He says it was part of a presentation he'd made that afternoon to a graphics class.
To be honest, it was a reenactment of a comedy skit, Monty Python to be precise. It was called How Not to Be Seen. It was a demonstrational video on, well, how to remain hidden. The premise of it being that when someone stood up, thereby being seen, they would get shot. When I left the class, I didn't really have anywhere else to put the gun, because I'd left my backpack with my girlfriend in the cafeteria. So I had no choice but to carry it in my hand. And I suppose when I got back to the cafeteria, that's when they found me.
That's Christopher Hardy. After student shootings at Virginia Tech and Dawson College, institutions all over North America have become much more sensitive to guns on campus. Hardy admits he wasn't really thinking about that when he brought the pellet gun to Memorial University.
Well, if I had my time back, I definitely wouldn't have taken it with me. But I just basically want people to know that I'm not a criminal. I don't really think I should be punished for this. I made a mistake, yes. That's abundantly clear. It was definitely the most bizarre experience of my life. Bizarre, frightening, and exciting all at the same time. Actually, when I got home and I realized the magnitude of all of it, when I was in the police station being interviewed, I had no idea what was going on outside. So when I got home and realized how many people had their eyes on this and how many people were talking about it, and, well, most importantly, the things were being said about me, that was pretty hard. I lost a lot of sleep last night over it. People even assuming that I was trying to get attention out of it. And people who didn't know the full story basically talking like, I was some kind of criminal or idiot. I suppose, being somewhat intelligent is always something I've valued. So, I realize I made a lapse in judgment, but when people are calling me stupid for it, and even worse, people think I'm a criminal, I'm not a criminal. That's something that's very difficult to handle for me. I just want to be able, I don't really care that much about what people think ultimately. I'll get over that, but I just really want to be able to go back to school and finish my degree, normally. I don't know, I'm expecting some kind of reprimand. I don't know if it'll be anything major or not, but I don't know, I would just like them to take me back and, so I can continue my studies without any more of this.
Christopher Hardy is a third-year engineering student at Memorial University. The administration didn't evacuate any buildings or sound a general alarm during the search for Hardy, but it did post a message on its news site and circulated an email to students, faculty, and staff. It included a request that people assist in finding an unknown man who had a pellet gun. Paula Gale of Radio Noon visited the campus to see how people were reacting to the incident and Munn's handling of it.
Matt Howell. Well, he shouldn't have gotten in here, would it, first of all. Like, how did a guy get in here with a pellet gun? Oh, makes you feel a bit unsafe, but gotta trust people.
Terror scars. I think it's crazy, actually. I really do. Like, how someone can walk in with a pellet gun and no one notice the difference at all. It's just, I don't know. It's not right.
Chad Petten.
How do you think of how Memorial University handled that situation?
I think they've done a pretty good job, it's not really something that happens all the time, and I guess they're not really used to it. So it was kind of they'll see how it was received by the students. I think it was pretty effective. I know that I never checked my email until I got home, which was around 5 o'clock, and I never knew about it until then. So it was happening, and I was unaware of it. But I think you know, that's the best they could have done. I really don't see what else they could have done.
I'm Chris Richardson. I don't really know what to say. I guess what they did was right in trying to find the guy. One of the guys in my sociology class actually knew the guy, and it turns out that he brought an empty pellet gun for a demonstration, and the professor already knew about it. So in the end, it was just a big misunderstanding. So, but I guess given the situation, the university obviously did the right thing in trying to send out information saying, have you seen this guy?
I'm James Pilling. I was there at a lab, and a police woman came in and just did a walk around to see if anyone was there. And so I'm not sure exactly what time the university sent around the memo. I know I got it when I got home. However, I did already know about it when I was there. So for me, the timing was still fine. I was, you know, at least aware of the incident before I got the email. I know I can understand why some people would have concern as to why only an email was sent and that they wouldn't necessarily know about it beforehand. But I think in a university like this one where we don't have any problems with guns or anything for the most part, that they didn't start a panic in the university, which is probably actually for the best anyway.
Jessica Hickey. I really have to ask, what's the big deal? It was just a pellet gun. It's not like it was a real gun. It's like the same difference of saying, yeah, I know you're not allowed to bring knives to school, but that's like saying you can't bring a plastic knife either. It's not a real weapon, and if it was just brought in for a presentation, and it was empty, it's not even an actual weapon. I've been hit with pellet guns before. They don't actually hurt. I think a paintball gun is more dangerous.
That was Paula Gale speaking to some students at Memorial University. For its part, the university says it acted appropriately. Ivan Muzichka is manager of news services.
Well, I guess our reaction is being characterized at both polls. Some people think we underreacted and some people think we overreacted. As you know, what happened was we received a report from a couple of students who saw a male drop what appeared to be a gun on the floor. He retrieved it and said, it's just my pellet gun, and moved on. And we contacted, our CEP officials contacted the RNC. Once this investigation began, the university decided, that we needed to communicate about this, that it might be a good idea to do so. Now, that's part of our operating principle. We tend to be open with our communications. But we checked with the RNC, who were undertaking this investigation with our CEP officials. That's the Campus Security Force. We work closely with both of those agencies when something like this happens. And our interest is to protect, obviously to ensure campus safety and security. And any communication we undertake is done with that in mind. We don't want to unduly panic people. And a great concern for us is we don't want to jeopardize or hamper an investigation being undertaken by the RNC and our own campus security personnel. We checked with them, and the RNC basically left it to us. They didn't give us any indication that we needed to evacuate the campus or anything like that. We asked the RNC if a communication would be a problem, and they said that it wouldn't hurt, and that was our call. And we decided to communicate on the matter. In fact, it turns out that it helped, and we're pleased about that. But what we did was we sent an email to our newsline service, which goes to the employees of the university. It goes to the students' union, who then transfer it on further to students who are subscribed to their email listserv. And we also posted it to our news site.
Memorial University's manager of news services, Ivan Muzichka. By the way, he says Christopher Hardy didn't break any university regulations by bringing the pellet gun on campus and showing it to students. I'm John Soper, and you're listening to Newfoundland and Labrador This Week. The crowd was clearly on Rick Hillier's side in St. John's Thursday night. Canada's Chief of Defence Staff got a standing ovation as he appeared in his home province. The venue, the municipality's Newfoundland and Labrador Conference. The message, Canada's soldiers are doing important work in Afghanistan. Here's a little of what he had to say about the challenges facing the troops.
These are the people that we are there to support. And you know, they look differently. They talk a different language. Their culture, their recreation is differently. Their food, their diet is different. But actually, they're all the same. And all they want is to live a life now without a threat. And they'd like to have hope that life is going to be better tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. But in particular, that life is going to be better for their children. And they take the long-term view. If we convince them and if they are convinced that 10 years from now, as they say this, if 10 years from now, if life is going to be better for my children, I can put up with anything for that 10 years because I put up with a lot already. And that's all they ask for is our help to get them started in rebuilding their country so they don't have to worry when they go shopping for food about dying from a suicide bomber, so that maybe they have medical care available and maybe their children can get educated. We're doing all of that, and we're working with them to help them rebuild their countries because there is a very real threat. And it's the Taliban, supported by other terrorist groups, who refuse to allow a democratic process to work and use violence to prevent it. The Afghans cannot yet handle that by themselves, that threat, and they need some help to do it as they build their army and their police force to be able to handle it themselves. And that threat and the resulting violence has caused a lot of chaos in Afghanistan that's led to things like this. These are the poppy fields in southern Afghanistan. And in the early spring, you see them flowering, and the fields are absolutely beautiful, and they go on for kilometers. Last year, as a result of those poppies, some 3,500 tons of opium were produced, 95% of that going to Western Europe, 5% of it going to the western part of North America, and about half of that going into Canada via Vancouver. And so if you want to talk about a weapon of mass destruction with a slow fuse, that would be one of them. Forest of marijuana plants as a result of that chaos. And those plants are 6 to 10, sometimes 11 feet tall, taller than our LAV-3 fighting vehicles. And that's important because the Taliban have learned that our thermal sights can't look inside of the forest of the marijuana plants. Marijuana plants absorb energy and they absorb water. And so when you go into the plant, our thermal sights can look through most plants and that and be able to follow somebody because of the body signature you give off. You cannot do that in a marijuana plant forest. And so what they would do is get in there, pop out, and shoot a rifle-propelled grenade at us, and then pop back in, and you can't track them with the LAV-3 sights. Our guys tried some unique ways to clean that up. They tried burning with white phosphorus the marijuana plants. They tried it with diesel. No success because the marijuana plant retains water right up to the last days before you harvest it. Unfortunately, we did have one section of plants right on the edge that were brown and dry already catch on fire. But equally unfortunately, we had one of our rifle sections of 10 men downwind from that fire, and we couldn't keep up with the munchies on order after that, so we had to throw that little approach out the window.
That was the Chief of Defense Staff, General Rick Hillier. He was speaking in St. John's. Now, during the week, the Family Military Resource Center in Gander was boxing up what they call Christmas morale packages for 50 of those troops Hillier was talking about. The boxes are full of goodies, including a few reminders of home. Reporter David Zeltzer was at the center as the volunteers got everything ready to go.
So it's like an assembly line. We'll just start, pick up the packages. You can go around, probably start this side, and fill the package. My name is Carol Ann McWhirter. I'm the Deployment Support Coordinator here at the Gander Military Family Resource Center. My job here at the center, as part of my job, is to coordinate these Christmas packages. We started right back in September collecting things for the packages.
Ooh. A couple of bucks will be good.
Well, my name is Véronique Tessier, and I'm here because I'm a military spouse. And my husband's been in the alert last year, and he received a box like that in Christmas, and he was very happy to receive it, so that's why I'm here.
We have magazines from Newfoundland Sportsman. We also have tree ornaments that have messages on them. Goodies, Newfoundland Purity products, fun items for Christmas, like a Christmas hat and lights. We have socks. We have toothbrushes and toothpaste. We also have Purity candy, and Kraft dinner is another hot item. We have hot chocolate that they can take and put in their pockets. We have the Purity cookies. We also have a fun toy that will just enlighten the mood. We have sausages that Newfoundlanders will be, I'm sure, will find that when they get those, that'll be a memory from home. We have the coffee from Tim Hortons, and we have chocolate and chips and jam.
My name is Bernadine. I'm here helping send the packages to the soldiers overseas. Just our way of helping out and saying thanks to all the guys over there. My husband is currently deployed in Afghanistan, and just wanted to send him, you know, package as well, and hope he's home soon.
They go to wherever the members are deployed. They'll go to Afghanistan, to the Sudan, alert, and sometimes there's members who are away just in Canada who are away from their families for Christmas on course or whatever, so we send those packages to them too.
My name is Ron Ludi, and I'm here helping out at the Family Resource Center to send some packages over to our soldiers over in Afghanistan. My son Craig is a captain in the military, and he was deployed last year and got home in February, so we got involved as a family, my wife and I, Georgina, and we came and enjoyed it last year and seen the fruits of our labor, and so we thought we'd come back again this year, even though he's not over there this year, but there are our fighting soldiers are over there fighting on our behalf, so I thought it's the least we could do at a time like Christmas.
My name is Allison Dockery, and I came out to help today. My husband was deployed for Christmas this time last year, so I'm just coming to help. I know that the package made a huge difference to his morale last year, so I'd like to help those families that have their loved ones gone this Christmas and send off packages to them.
And just in case you were wondering, yes, those sausages the soldiers are getting are those Vienna sausages that are so near and dear to so many hearts in Newfoundland and Labrador. John Furlong of the Fisheries Broadcast was on a road trip this month. One of his stops was in Twillingate, home to one of the most outspoken fishermen in the province, Jack Troke. He's widely known as a champion of the pro-seal hunt movement and a strong advocate for rural communities. But John thought we haven't heard much from Jack's wife, Florence Troke. John sat down at her kitchen table for a wide-ranging chat about their lives, the seal hunt, and the future of rural Newfoundland and Labrador.
Now, Florence, we hear an awful lot about Jack Troke, but we don't hear much about Florence Troke. Tell me a little bit about yourself and your life, your early life in Twillingate.
Well, I went to school here in Twillingate, and I only went so far as grade 9. I quit then and went to work at a restaurant here. And then, well, not very long, I had to be married. Me and Jack was going together for 4 years, and then it happened that I had been married, so we got married.
Where did you meet Jack?
Meeting in the Salvation Army. Coming out of the Salvation Army. We were both united, but when we leave the United Church sometimes, I would go to the Army, and Jack and he would come up around then, and that's how I met him, walking down the road. So that's how I met him.
Tell me, Florence, what was it about Jack that attracted you to him?
Well, he was nice looking, I must say that. And apart from that, we just, I don't know if anything else, you know, right when we met him then, you know. But after we started going together, I knew that he was a good working man. He was only young. He was only 17 years old. And that's it. When I married Jack, he went with the CNR. He worked with the CNR for years. And then he gave up in 1972 and he went with the railway. And then he started fishing then in between, like, sort of thing, you know. But he went out to house out the ceiling for several years. And it is a stressful life for a wife when they're left behind with two children. And you worry about the weather, what the weather's going to be like, and house conditions, and wondering if it's going to get back safe and sound. And you couldn't hear from them then. It's only by Gerald Starr's news you hear, and sometimes somebody at a radio that you would listen to the news, see where the boat was, you know. And then after that, then he's longliner, he's on longliner, he used to go to the ceiling air. And it was still a difficult thing, you know, because you didn't know if they get stuck in the house and there'd be danger and the weather was bad and wondering what they would do when they come in, you know, wondering about the protest crowd, if they were going to be around with this, you know, and the price they were going to get for their seals. But the main thing was that we just prayed that they would get back safe and sound.
What kind of living did the fishing provide for you in your life? Was it a good, you know, are your memories of the fishery and growing up with a family that provided from the fishery, are they good memories?
Oh, yes. I grew up, my father was a fisherman all of his life. And when we were a small kid, we used to have to help, like, spread the fish and take the fish up in the evenings and look, see if there was a storm coming, that we'd have to have it up, you know. And we'd go down, I was just like a boy. I'd go down on the stage here and I'd cut out tongues, and Dad would drive me home more than once. Now get up, you know, not come down anymore. But that's how I used to like that. And I used to go out and help pull the traps. I'd go out with them in the trap boats and watch them pull the traps and that, you know.
Now tell me, you talked about the controversy of the seal hunt. What's that like, being embroiled in that when your husband is such a flashpoint for the anti-seal hunt movement, because he's so heavily involved in the seal hunt? I mean, what's your view on the animal rights groups?
Well, I think the seal hunt, I think it should go on. I don't think it should, you know, they're trying to downgrade it, or maybe a year to come that there will be no seal hunt. But I think they make a good living at seal hunt. I know Jack have, and even my two boys, when they were at it, you know, they could make a good living at seal hunt.
What do you make of the number of people who have been in your house over the course of the years to come here, and Jack has been, your husband has been host to them, and you've been host to them? What's that been like to meet so many people from around the world?
Oh, yeah, it's excellent. I love to meet people, and Jack do too, you know. And when they come here, they're like one of your family. I'll go on and put the kettle on and get a cup of tea and a lunch for them, and a lot of them will stay there so long as like 2 weeks. So, you know, I think they're wonderful, you know. It's good to have the journalists there. You know, I think it helps with the fish, right?
Does it bother you when Jack streels so many people home, though, when it's a short notice?
Yes, sometimes I could kill them. Honest to God, sometimes I could kill them. But after they get in there, you know, the first thing comes to your mind, oh, my, what are you going to get them for to eat? You know, because Jack, as soon as they're into the door, is on with the kettle. Don't make no difference if you got anything with it or not, or just a cup of tea. But, no, I enjoy it, too, you know. I think that's great.
Now, one of the sad realities of the fishery is that it claims so many lives, and you lost a son to the fishery. That must have been an awfully difficult period. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, I tell you, it is hard to lose a son, because in the first beginning, I don't think a parent should have to bury a child. But the way that Gary went, if he was sick, and we know that he was really sick and he was going to pass away, I mean, we'd be prepared for it. But for him to live on a Sunday morning and go out there, and when they found him and he had himself tied to the boat, I think he must have, I don't know about suffered, but he must have wondered, you know, what's going to happen to him. And the reason he tied himself on the boat, I guess, was because they said, well, they get my body anyway. And on top of that, my granddaughter lost her husband with it, and they didn't even get his body. And I tell you, it's difficult. It's difficult. You go on in life, you know, but it's difficult to lose a son or lose any child.
Does it make you nervous about Jack still being involved in it, and you have another son who's still involved in the fishery?
Yeah, I'm more nervous now than I ever was, because when they go out and boat, you know, I lost Gary, and the wind comes up and that, and I wonder where they're to, and that, you know, especially Artie when he's out there alone. When his father's with him, I don't seem so bad, you know, but when he's out there alone, I wonder if he's doing this or doing that, and wondering what the weather's going to be like, and see if he's going to get in safe and sound.
First, just talk a little bit about life in Twillingate and the difference now. Is it a changed place? I mean, there seems to be a lot of life in Twillingate, but you were telling me before we talked that it's not as lively as it used to be. But what's life like in Twillingate now these days?
Well, I think life is great in Twillingate these days. There's so much for people to do. There is a lot of our things closed down. But then again, there's lots of things there for them to do. Like there's a lot of walking trails, and there's two museums there, and there's Long Point Lighthouse there, and the hospital is there. It's not working real, you know, but it's still here. And there's different things going on at night in the summer. There's shows going on, and there's a dinner theater here that entertains, and there's a lot of restaurants there that you can go to. And I think it's a great place.
But it sounds like what you might be saying is that the future of rural Newfoundland may have more to do with tourism than it does with fishery.
Oh, yes, most definitely. There's more tourism place now than it is fishery place.
And do you think that that's the way of the future for some parts of rural Newfoundland?
I think it is for Twillingate, and maybe other parts. You know, I'm not sure about that, but I think it is for Twillingate.
Florence, one of the things that people talk about these days throughout Newfoundland and Labrador is out-migration, families commuting back and forth to Alberta to work. I mean, what's your thought on that?
Well, I don't know what all the fuss is about, tell you the truth, because years ago when I got married, I mean, married Jack. Jack was only 17 years old. And then I had Artie. And when I had Artie, Jack, he was a month old, and Jack left and went away. Artie was 8 months old before he seen him anymore. And then when I had Gary, the same thing. Jack wasn't even home when I had Gary. And his father sent him a message and said, baby Brian and Florence, both feeling fine. He didn't even know if I had a boy or a girl. So, but my brother then went away and met him, and he asked him what I had, and he said he had a boy. And I don't know what all this fuss is about. They'll get married now, and they'll have kids, and by and by they can't do it, and they'll say, well, I got to go away. So they go away for a month, probably 3 months, 4 months, and then they'll all pack up and take the family with them. I mean, it's a big deal, because, I mean, I was there. I had to rear up my two children. I didn't even have no electricity, no hydro, no bathroom or anything. And I brought mine up, and I used to have to take one on the arm and the other one by the hand and go across the road to get my wood and bring my water. So, and there was no push buttons then. Like, you'd have it washed by hand, and you'd have dry it on the line, bring it in, froze. But I can't see what the big fuss is about. Why they can't, you know, why they have to follow their husbands like that. I know it's not easy. Yes, it's sure it's not easy, because I got a granddaughter that her husband goes away. And she'll say, oh, my. She said, this is some long day. This is some long night. And I said, Dana, I said, what's the difference? He's coming back again. So, that's one thing I can't understand.
Does it? How do you feel about your own husband's involvement in the fishery and being such a vocal proponent of not only the fishery but of rural Newfoundland? I mean, do you ever reach a point where you say, listen, Jack, why don't you just shut up and let's enjoy a nice quiet life?
Yes, I've told him that many a time. Shut up, Jack, and don't do no more. Because he's always at it by phone and on a fisherman's broadcast and CBC and everything, in the boat or in the books and all that. I mean, I said, it's time for him to give it up now at his age. You've done enough.
Okay, Florence, well, certainly nice to meet you and certainly nice to talk to you. Appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you.
And that was Florence Troke of Twillingate. She was speaking with Fisheries Broadcast host John Furlong. That's it for this week's podcast. You can get in touch with us at cbc.ca by clicking Contact Us. Throughout the week, you can come up with stories from around Newfoundland and Labrador at cbc.ca/NL. I'm John Soper. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.